Our gospel reading this morning comes from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8, beginning in verse 27. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." He asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in glory, in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Well, I have a question for you this morning, and I expect every one of you to come to me with the answer to this question after the service. If a train leaves Chicago at 6 a.m., and another leaves New York at 8 a.m., and both are going 50 miles an hour, what time will they pass each other? You got it? You got to get the question. This is a question that probably struck fear into our hearts and minds this morning, especially as we recollect our seventh grade math class and our teacher demanding that we go to the blackboard to show our work. You know, even if you are a math whiz, everybody knows that it is not enough to just get the right answer. You have to get the right answer for the right reason. And the math teacher wants to make sure that you even do it in the right way. The right answer for the wrong reason can get you into a pile of trouble. You can also get the wrong answer for the right reason, of course. A father was helping his 7-year-old daughter learn about email, and he watched over her shoulder as she typed in her password, which was Mickey, Minnie, Goofy, Pluto, all one word, no spaces in between. And he asked, "Why such a long password?" And she responded, "Because Daddy Google says the password has to have at least 4 characters. You know, one day Peter got the right answer to one of Jesus' questions, but for the wrong reason. "Who do people say that I am?" he asked his disciples. And the disciples responded, "Some say John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." And Jesus presses the point, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter instantly pipes up with the right answer. "You are the Messiah," he says. "You are the Christ. You are God's anointed one. You are God's earthly representative who is going to win God's kingdom back." And what Peter means by this is that he thinks that Jesus is the knight who the queen is going to tap with her sword. He thinks he's the general that the president is going to appoint to wage the battle. Peter gets the right answer, but for the wrong reason. For Peter, the Messiah means the restoration of Israel's hopes and dreams and spirits. For Peter, the Christ means riding into Jerusalem and ridding it of Roman soldiers. For Peter, the Messiah means storming the imperial palace in Rome and throwing Caesar from the throne. For Peter, the Christ is Sherman's march to the sea. That's what Peter thinks the Messiah is. For months now, Jesus has been preaching. He's been throwing demons into the sea. He's been making lame men walk and blind men see. He's been silencing the winds and waves. He's been mobilizing the lowly for action. He has unearthly powers, and they've never seen anyone quite like him. "This is it," thinks Peter. "The longed-for restoration of Israel is at hand," and Peter gets the right answer. "You are the Christ." But it's for the wrong reason. Now, there's a very small detail in this story that we cannot miss. This story doesn't happen in Galilee. Galilee was the Jewish territory of Jesus' Nazareth home. The story doesn't happen in Jerusalem either, the Jewish capital and home to God's holy temple. All of this happens in a town called Caesarea Philippi. And Caesarea Philippi is 40 miles northeast of Nazareth. It's deep in enemy territory. Caesarea Philippi is named for two great world leaders, Caesarea for Caesar Augustus, perhaps the most powerful man that the world had ever seen, and Philippi for Philip, the son of Herod the Great. And so it was built to honor Caesar and rebuilt by one of the Herods. And people worshiped Caesar as a god in a temple at Caesarea Philippi. And when Peter says, "You are the Christ," he proclaims this deep within enemy territory. This is worse than wearing a Red Sox hat at Yankee Stadium this time of year. You're going to get more than a beer dumped all over you. This is insolent. This is going to get you thrown into whatever Rikers Island there was in that day. And perhaps that's why Jesus instantly tells his disciples never to say that again. You know, Peter does get the right answer, but for the wrong reason. And Jesus begins to explain what it really means to be the Christ. "The Son of Man must suffer many things," he says, "be rejected by the chief priests and be killed." That's what it means to be the Christ. And Peter is furious at this. Mark tells us that Peter takes Jesus aside and begins to rebuke him. Imagine that condescending attitude of Peter, taking Jesus out of the earshot of the disciples, telling him to shut up. To which Jesus replies, get behind me, Satan. You know, you can see why he says this, can't you? Jesus means to exemplify what it really means to be the Christ, and Peter is getting in his way. Peter has to be harshly rebuked. "Get behind me, Satan. Get behind me, Peter. Don't order me around. Don't tell me what to do. You're not out in front. You are to follow Jesus." You know, it's not enough to get the right answer. You have to get the right answer for the right reason. And Jesus means to show Peter and the disciples and each one of us what it means to be the Christ. That being the Christ doesn't mean killing, but it means dying. Being the Christ doesn't mean winning, it means losing. Being the Christ doesn't mean storming the imperial palace in Rome and throwing Caesar from his throne. It rather means carrying your cross to Golgotha. Being the Christ means the cross and not the sword. God has other plans for the Christ, and God sometimes has other plans for us. On November 13th, 1861, President Lincoln and Secretary of State William Seward called on General George McClellan at the general's home in Washington. And you have to bear with me because this is kind of a long story, but there's a point to it, I promise. And 2 weeks before, President Lincoln had appointed McClellan as commander-in-chief of the Union Army. And President Lincoln was fortunate to have McClellan as his top soldier. He was a prodigy. He hailed from a prominent family in Philadelphia. He was second in his class at West Point. And even though he was 2 years younger than the rest of his classmates, he was named president of a railroad at age 30, and now was the youngest general among the Union troops. He was famous and beloved throughout the northern states. Americans called him the young Napoleon. But all of this privilege and talent and opportunity went to his head, and it gave him a superiority complex. To his subordinates and in letters to his wife, he repeatedly disparaged the president's intelligence. And so on November 13th, 1861, President Lincoln and Secretary Seward called on General McClellan. And they wanted to know one thing from him. Why was he not winning the battle with the largest and best-equipped army in the world? Why couldn't he chase down a Confederate army that was perhaps half as big as his own? When the president and the secretary got to the general's house, a servant tells them that the general had gone to a wedding and might not be back for some time. But you're welcome to wait. I mean, imagine that picture, the president and the secretary of state. You can wait, it's not that important. So the president and the secretary wait at the parlor at the general's house, and an hour goes by. And finally, Lincoln asks a servant if the general will be home soon. To which the servant replies, "Oh, he's been home for a while now. He was tired and went to bed." You know, Seward is furious. He wants to demote the general on the spot, but the president says, "Let it pass. I'll hold the general's horse for him if he will bring me victory." You know, Abraham Lincoln might have been one of the most egoless Americans that has ever lived. I want you to fast forward three summers to the summer of 1864. McClellan has long since been fired for incompetence. The war is going horribly for the Union. Their huge armies keep getting demolished by smaller, underfed, undergunned Confederate forces. And in the summer of 1864, Lincoln is hated by most Americans. And with the presidential election of 1864 fast approaching, many of you will remember who his opponent was, General George McClellan. Where was the Democratic Convention that year? It was in Chicago, the president's home state. And the Democrats were calling the war a failure and preparing to negotiate with the Confederacy, which would have, of course, meant a perpetuation of slavery. And the president is all but certain that he will lose. And in August of 1864, they begin packing their boxes for what they think is going to be an early exit from the White House. And then something remarkable happens. On September 1st, 69 days before the election, General Sherman runs the American flag, up the flagpole in Atlanta. And you can't exaggerate the impact of the victory. The war will last for 7 more months. President Lincoln wins the 1864 election in a landslide, and he gets the opportunity to deliver his second inaugural address. And now you may see where I'm going with this. President Lincoln's second inaugural address has been called his greatest speech. I'm not quite sure if it's his greatest. Gettysburg was pretty good also. But it certainly was his most scriptural and also his most theological. And it's a gloss on our gospel lesson this morning. On the cusp of that Union victory, in the midst of Sherman's horrible march to the sea, in the face of some 700,000 killed, with the reality that many southern cities were burned to the ground, with the sobering fact that this war was fought over the institution of slavery, and the war soon being over in just 35 days, President Lincoln defines the meaning of the war. He talks not about triumph, but of punishment on both North and South alike. For the ancient scourge of slavery, the president's egolessness, his humility, his astute theological reading of history is the reason that Alabama and Massachusetts are still in the same country. And he says, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." At the White House after the speech, President Lincoln asked his friend Frederick Douglass what he thought about the speech. And Douglass responded, "Mr. President, that was a secret effort." Douglass always said that it sounded more like a sermon than a speech. "Take up your cross. Take up your cross," Jesus says to Peter in response to getting the right answer for the wrong reason. "If any of you want to follow me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel, will save it. Amen.